Also on RN on Breakfast this week, Elizabeth Culbert talked about her now famous book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Yes, there have been five other massive extinctions, and few understood until recently what was behind them. Elizabeth Culbert is talking from her home in the US with my colleague Greg Borschmann.
Crafting a credible script for the end of the world as we know it is fraught for any science fiction writer. It's even more fraught when you're talking about the real thing. And blaming it on humans. So for credibility reasons alone, you'd expect the task would fall to a well-credentialed, peer-reviewed scientist. It didn't. Journalist Elizabeth Culbert, staff writer for the New Yorker magazine since 1999, took on the job. She admits she needed lots of help. So why did she do it?
The reason such a book could be written by a journalist, and on some level maybe even had to be written by a journalist, is that scientists are increasingly specialized. Everyone is looking at a narrow slice of the problem. And although many of the people that I certainly went out with have a very big picture view, they don't really talk to each other that much.
Is that a bit of a worry? If they're not talking to each other, they're probably not talking to anyone else, certainly the wider public.
Well, I think that one of the reasons, really, that people were so generous with their time to me and I got to go on some quite extraordinary expeditions is that they really would like this message and the contents of their work to reach a wider public. But that is not the job of scientists for all sorts of structural reasons that have to do with what scientists have to do to get grants, and it's generally to publish in scientific journals. It's not to be a popularizer, which is actually a very fraught occupation for scientists.
Can we come to what's been called the sixth great extinction, or the Anthropocene, later? Let's look first at those earlier mass extinction events. The world has seen five of them in the last 450 million years. What triggered them? Because they're all different, weren't they?
Yes, and there was a moment in time, if we'd had this conversation maybe 20 years ago, people might have told you, well, maybe we will find some commonality to all of these events. We're going to find sort of the key that unlocks them all. But I think people have rather given up on that. There does not seem to be just one single cause that can explain all of these mass extinctions in the record. And in fact, the thinking has come sort of 180 degrees. And now what I've heard scientists say is, well, perhaps it's just the fact that they're so freakish. They haven't happened before in the history of life that makes them so devastating, because obviously, if you've never encountered something in evolutionary history, it's that much more dangerous.
Yes, but climate change and catastrophe certainly figure highly.
Yes, climate change of one kind or another. I mean, if we look all the way back to the very first of these extinctions about 440 million years ago, when life was still predominantly confined to the water, there was very little life on land at that point. It seems to have been caused by a sudden cold snap, a glaciation event. And then when we look at the very worst of all mass extinctions, which occurred about 250 million years ago, that was a very warm spell. That was a time of very significant climate change in the opposite direction.
In some ways, the most recent extinction that happened at the end of the Cretaceous, 65 million years ago, is the most interesting, not just because it wiped out any land-based animal bigger than a cat, including the great dinosaurs, but because even until the last decade or two, there's been enormous dispute about what actually caused it.
Yes, one of the interesting things that happened is that Darwin, to name one very, very important figure in this story, didn't believe that there was such a thing as mass extinction. He felt that all extinctions happened individually. Species died out because they were outcompeted by another species. And that was the dominant view from Darwin to very recently. And even when people saw in the fossil record these moments when there seemed to have been very sharp breaks and very calamitous drops in the diversity of life on Earth, they were sort of embarrassed by that. They didn't know what to make of that. They just said, well, we must be missing something here. And then in the 80s, a pair of American scientists out at UC Berkeley came up with the theory of what had caused the dinosaurs to go extinct and many, many other creatures, and they posited that it was an asteroid impact. And that really flew in the face of this idea that there's only gradual change on Earth. This was a sudden and disastrous event, and it caused a real ruckus in science, and it took quite a while for people to get their minds around that. But now it is quite widely accepted that the dinosaurs and 75% of species on Earth were killed off in quite short order by an asteroid impact 65 million years ago.
It's incredible, isn't it? Because when that theory first came out, as you say, in the late 80s, early 90s, it was described as codswallop.
It's actually a sort of very interesting story about how science does respond to the evidence. And that's a case where scientists had to look at the evidence. At first, they resisted it, but eventually the evidence became overwhelming.
Elizabeth Colbert says the evolutionary history of the world is a story featuring, quote, long periods of boredom interrupted occasionally by panic. So are we in one of those periods of panic? And how did a so-called weedy species, Homo sapiens, come to be the culprit?
Well, the Anthropocene is the definition of it, if you will, is it a new geological epoch in which human influences on the planet are the dominant influences, even on a geological level. And there's a great deal of sort of formal debate about this in geological circles. Even as we speak, should we formally rename the period that we live in, which is officially known as the Holocene? And its defining characteristics would be, have human impacts really overwhelmed the great forces of geology that have shaped our planet for hundreds of millions of years? And increasingly, many, many scientists would say, yes, we have become the dominant force on the planet. We're clearly not the only force on the planet, but we have become the dominant.
But you detail recent extinctions or near extinctions, the Panamanian golden frog, the great auk, the Sumatran rhino, but you then say there's a bigger point. It's the pattern that they're participating in. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that we can see what links this current extinction event to the past extinction events is very dramatic changes going on at a rate that many species can't adapt quickly enough to. And that is really, unfortunately, what's going on and why we are in danger of precipitating another very, very serious extinction event, because we are changing the world, and ocean acidification is a very good example of that. Reefs have gone out in the past. There have been moments in time when there have been no reef-building organisms, and those are associated with some of the worst crises in the history of life. So that is not something to take lightly at all. That's something to take very, very seriously.
And you also highlight a contradiction that people care about extinction. Enormous efforts go into conserving the last of a species. For example, you point to the Hawaiian crow, extinct in the wild, but 100 left in captivity. And yet we're pushing our nearest relatives, other great apes, almost certainly over the abyss.
Yes, it is really interesting, and definitely one of the themes of the book is that people are many different things. What it means to be human is unfortunately full of contradiction, and one of these, as you say, is that we are absolutely heartbroken by the loss of a species, and I visited several animals who were among the very last of their kind, and the people who were taking care of them and desperately trying to keep these species alive, the Hawaiian crow, another one was the Sumatran rhino. We have basically 100, 200 individuals left, and people are going to tremendous efforts to try to keep the species alive. On the other hand, all of these forces of change that we've set in motion, climate change, ocean acidification, moving species around the world, which is a tremendous problem in Australia. You have, you know, tremendous problems with invasive species, as I don't need to tell you. Mowing down habitat, all of these big, big drivers of extinction continue. So you have this interesting way in which we go to great lengths for individual animals. We go to great lengths for the trees. Meanwhile, the forest continues to be felled.
So with the forest falling all around us, what's driving the inability to see that, or at least acting to prevent it? Instead of blaming the failings of science, is this a problem of perception, or simply belief? For example, a poll taken by the Pew Research Center in the US late last year found that a third, yes, one third, of all Americans reject the idea of evolution, including 64% of white evangelical Protestants and 48% of all Republican voters.
Yes, I think that we have a real unfortunate sort of mismatch between our capacity as a species to alter the planet using very, very sophisticated science and our sort of willingness to get our heads around what are some pretty basic scientific facts. I'm going to call evolution a scientific fact, and that is particularly true in the U.S., unfortunately.
I wonder why. Elizabeth Culbert from the New Yorker magazine with Greg Borschmann from RN Breakfast on her book, The Sixth Extinction.